Okay. So I'm going to tell you about some recent work that we've been doing with really who's been doing the work is a postdoc here, Ryuichi Shindu. If you're interested in it, you can read our rather difficult impenetrable paper. which is 603-089. I should just say from the outset that I'm not going to say anything practical about any specific system. It's the next half hour. So, I'm sorry. having apologized in the beginning, it will at least be spintronics and interactions, which was what was asked about. So there are a lot of things one can look at once thinking about interaction effects and magnetism and solids, and of course, all actual magnetic order requires interaction, ferromagnetism, anti-ferromagnetism. What's intrigued me, and a lot of people, I think, built up a lot of the energy in spintronics lately has been this notion of intrinsic spintronics, by which I mean effects that arise from spin-orbit coupling already in the band structure. Okay, so that is in the band structure. Not associated with defects or impurities scattering in any way. And there are a couple of examples of these sorts of what sort of effects these lead to that have been pretty interesting. The list seems to be growing. Probably the most robust of these and the most measured is the anomalous Hall effect. But of course, there's been a lot of interest also in this spin Hall effect. I put quotes around it. So both these things, there are some others that have been talked about a lot, intrinsic effects more recently, like quantum spin Hall effect. But I want to stick with these that occur in metals. Why metals? Well, metals are sort of the classic venue for solid-state physics. If we want to understand kind of fundamental effects in solids, probably we should understand metals. You can hope that it has a wide applicability. I also find it kind of fundamentally interesting because our basic understanding of metals is really semi-classical. The reason we can understand metals is that they're the systems where KFL is very big, the best systems. What's fundamentally interesting about this kind of intrinsic spintronics is really the fact that it's kind of a very basic revision, at least to me, having taught solid-state physics for the last few years. I was kind of amused and intrigued by the fact that basically these spin-orbit effects constituted, if you want, a revision of something that you're all taught in your first course on solid-state physics, the semi-classical model. I call it the Ashcroft and Merman level semi-classical model of electron dynamics. And what revises it is a rather interesting thing, which theorists generally like, are Berry phase effects. So this has kind of a long history back to Karpeles and Luttinger, has been, I think, most recently, very elegantly emphasized by Jian Yu and collaborators. I think I have to keep this thing from going blank on it. Good. So I'm not sure how much I need to review this for this audience, but I think I should review it a little bit, probably. So the basic idea of this, let me remind you a little bit about semi-classical electron dynamics. As Alan MacDonald emphasized earlier, the basic fact about metals is that they have extended states, which are described by Bloch's theorem. So we can write the wave function as Planck waves on some periodic part. In general, this will depend on spin as well. I'm going to kind of suppress it. Okay. But that's actually crucial. And these states being periodic, so they have the periodicity of the Bronate lattice, they're basically more or less like to solve the Schrodinger equation for them, you're solving particle in a box states. So they have a discrete spectrum, those are the energy bands. Something like this. So if you sit at a fixed quasi momentum, you have some set of discrete states. And there are actually two, if we take this intrinsic point of view, so that, I guess I should emphasize this from the outset, we're going to incorporate spin orbit effects into the band structure. So implicitly, I'm imagining that any impurity scattering effects, the mean free path is always long, not only compared to the Fermi wavelength, but also compared to some characteristic length over which electrons process by spin orbit interaction. So then there are actually two kind of classes of solids, periodic solids, that one should worry about, basically ones with and without inversion symmetry. So let me simplify my life and worry about solids that do not have inversion symmetry. So without inversion symmetry, or we could imagine we break time reversal like in a ferromagnet. Either one is sufficient. Unless both symmetries are present, generically these bands are not degenerate. Okay. Because if you do have both I and T, then by combining I and T, you change K to minus K and back again, and you obtain a new degenerate state. And bands in a inversion symmetric solid are generally twofold degenerate, even with spin orbit, which is kind of amazing. I suspect I will not have a chance to talk about that situation. So the classic way of thinking about electron motion is then we imagine we add, and of course these are eigenstates, so they're static. If you put an electron in one of these states, it doesn't evolve. On the other hand, if we do change the Hamiltonian a little bit, we add some fields, add some external forces, like electric and magnetic fields, for instance, that are slowly varying, then the classic notion is that provided these external forces are weak and slowly varying in space and time, the electron will just move within a band. In other words, it doesn't make Zener transitions. So the classic story that you'll hear when you read in Ashcroft and Merman is that the electron's velocity in real space is the group velocity of a wave. So just 1 over h bar k gradient epsilon n of k. Okay. And without spin orbit, you can prove that, actually. But actually, it's not generally correct. This is where it's, this is this point that I'm using. Ashcroft and Merman is wrong. And in fact, in general, there's an additional contribution which people call the anomalous velocity. Which you can understand as a Berry phase effect. So essentially, the idea is that if you apply these external forces, like an electric field, the electron indeed moves in k-space. If you think about its wave function evolving in time, it'll be proportional to stays in its band, proportional to this Bloch state at a time-varying wave vector. But in general, it accumulates a phase as it does this. And in fact, there's a geometrical component of that phase that only depends on the wave vector. And this 5k, the light has a form that you usually have in a Berry phase, which is, can be written like this. So you start, you move along whatever trajectory in k-space the electron evolves along, and you integrate this this inner product of the k-derivative of u with u. So this is just like any adiabatic quantum transport. The difference is that the adiabatic variable that's changing is the quasi-momentum. So this means that, I'm doing this kind of schematically to give you a picture of what's happening. If you look at the time derivative of this phase, its time derivative is proportional basically to the time derivative of the momentum. So this is, I should keep twiddles because I'm not being careful. So it's this thing times k dot. So this is like this time derivative, if you think kind of in a stationary phase approximation, this is like the local frequency at which this wave is evolving. Okay. And you can think of this as an additional component, if you want, to the energy, the frequency of that wave. And if we take its k derivative, this basically is the anomalous velocity. So you can see roughly what this looks like. It's two derivatives now of these block wave functions. And it turns out that it's, if you do this slightly more carefully, so this is the mu. There's this anti-symmetric derivative with respect to the two components of wave vector. And there's a reason you can understand this form. So if you think of this kind of as a geometrical phase, you can also write that phase as an integral of some vector potential. UN, DK, UN. But if you stare at it for a second, you realize that, well, this thing is pretty ambiguous. I have to tell you, Bloch's theorem tells me that the wave functions have this form, but I can choose an arbitrary phase for this periodic part of the Bloch function. So that is a sort of gauge invariance of my description, and physical planes should be independent of it. So I'm free to choose actually the phase of my Bloch functions arbitrarily at each k. And so this, if you want, vector potential is not independent of it. Physical quantities like the velocity of an electron wave should be independent of it, and actually this anomalous velocity here can be written just as the curl of it. So if A is a vector potential, this anomalous velocity is the magnetic field in that times that dotted into cross. So the velocity is related to this magnetic field. So this is kind of a dual or a fictitious magnetic field. So what does this thing all mean? Well, if you actually ask about the semi-classical equations for a Bloch wave, what they really should be is the form in Ashcroft and Merman. So the RDT is Vn of k plus actually this V of k cross dk to t. So that's another reason to call this thing a magnetic field. if you compare it to the equation of motion for the momentum, you know, you accelerate proportional to the electric field, and then there's some B cross the RDT. Where E and B, for whatever perverse reasons, I'm using E and B for the electric and magnetic fields. So this is kind of a magnetic field in momentum space.
So this fictitious field is gauge invariant?
Yes, it's gauge invariant because it's a curl. Yeah, so just like an ordinary vector potential, that transforms by gradient.
So I'm looking at this, so calling this. If I look at the second term on the equation for the RDT,
yeah,
it's supposed to look like a magnetic field, you're saying.
Well, so if you were to swap K and R,
okay,
it would be the magnetic field. Okay. Actually, I haven't. You could bring this out further. So the velocity is, you know, the K derivative of the energy, right? If I said H bar equals one, actually the electric field is the space derivative of the scalar potential. Some signs, but there's very, very close similarity of the top and bottom equations. In that sense, it's sort of a dual magnetic field.
Okay.
If you were to interchange momentum and position, I don't know, maybe you shouldn't take that as meaning that much. So I want to emphasize a pretty important difference between this and the usual semi-classical model you'll find in Ashcroft and Merman when this thing is gone, which is that In the usual block, in usual semi-classical equations, the wave functions don't enter. Okay, the dynamics usually is determined only by the energies. Okay. And that's not true now once we have these spin orbit effects. Okay. So to actually know the velocity of a wave pack, you need to know more than the energy. You actually need to know some property of the block wave function. So it's quite a different thing. There's actually another kind of simple way to understand this, a more physical way. I'm afraid of wasting too much time mentioning it, but I guess I can't resist, because if you haven't seen this, it's really very simple. So there's another way to understand this term. So if your system doesn't have inversion or time reversal, then in general, when you fix a specific wave vector, the block states are not inversion symmetric within the unit cell.
Okay.
So my un of k actually has an electric dipole moment. Call it D. So if you think about the wave function, it has some phase modulating it within, as you move from unit cell to unit cell, but within the unit cell it has some structure which is not inversion symmetric. So it has some dipole moment. If an electron then is moving in K space, that dipole moment depends on which K state you have, and the time-dependent dipole moment contributes a current. So the current of a block state is basically just the time derivative of its dipole moment, which is something like d d k mu d k mu d t. What's the dipole moment? Well, the dipole moment, being very naive, is something like the expectation value of the position operator. Which, you know, we know position is conjugate to momentum in quantum mechanics, so it could be something like minus I d by dk of u. You take another k derivative, you'll get this formula. Okay. There's this more physical way of understanding it. Okay. And again, the reason why there's this gauge structure is that you all know that dipole moment depends on your, and polarization generally depends on your origin. So it's not a well-defined thing, unless you pick some convention. So that's where the gauge structure is hidden. Polarization has this gauge structure to it.
Now, what if there is inversion time reversal symmetry in the system? because we know in some kind of spin on the coupling there is...
There's lots and lots of solids with inversion symmetry and, of course, time reversal. So this is extremely generic thing that there's inversion and time reversal. It's extremely interesting, and I cannot imagine I possibly can talk about it in the remaining 10 minutes. Okay, so I'm not going to try. I had a feeling this was going to happen. Okay, so this is going to be my review of intrinsic spintronics. You've all heard about spin Hall effect and anomalous Hall effect. Both these things, in some sense, arise from this term. If you apply an electric field, you have non-zero decay dt, and this gives a contribution to the velocity of an electron and hence the current. So, question I want to ask is, this is all beautiful physics. It's been done in a kind of single particle picture. How is this affected by interactions? What about interactions? Well, there are lots of different effects of interactions. I'm sure we'll hear about many of them today. There's certainly a very obvious important effect, which is that the block states you have in a real solid are not block states of some bare potential. There are at least, we should start out by considering some Hartree-Fock or density functional theory renormalized block states, renormalized bands. So that's certainly an important effect in practice. But in a sense, this is conceptually, I don't find it that interesting. It's sort of an obvious thing. What you measure are always the renormalized bands. The question is: are there actually qualitatively different effects in an interacting system that may modify this picture further? Okay. So in reality, there are at least three more effects. And actually, where this gets really subtle and interesting is in inversion symmetric materials, which I won't talk about. Largely, we don't understand it. What are the effects of interactions? Well, the way we understand them in metals, at least, is Fermi-liquid theory. Landau's Fermi-liquid theory. So what are the kind of new effects in Fermi-liquid theory? Well, the first one is that quasiparticles, so electrons are replaced by quasiparticles, and they interact. This interaction has been studied very carefully in the cleanest possible Fermi-liquid helium-3. And you can think of this interaction as being described by the Landau F functions. Another effect in an interacting system is that quasiparticles decay. As you move away from the Fermi energy, they have some lifetime, intrinsic lifetime, which goes like omega squared or t squared if we're lucky. We usually think we are. And think of this as scattering, if you want. And finally, they have a not unrelated effect, is that quasiparticles have reduced spectral weight. So this is usually not thought to be a very important effect if one's talking about transport properties, but it's something you can measure. It's been brought sort of more to the forefront by dramatic improvements in photo emission. Where you can measure the spectral function as function of frequency. And Landau told us in a Fermi liquid it should look something like this. It'd be a peak at some renormalized energy of a quasiparticle. And the weight of this in this peak is what's called Z, the renormalization factor, generally less than 1. That's this reduced spectral weight. The width of this peak is some definition of the the decay rate for a quasiparticle over tau. And what's lost in the wake shows up again in this, what's usually called the incoherent wave. And what these two effects really represent is the fact that the exact quasiparticle is not the same as a bare electron. It's a superposition of a bare electron plus the rest by some electron hole pairs. So we all know the basic ideas about this thing. The basic justification is Landau's kind of inspired idea that the exact quasiparticles are in one-to-one correspondence with bare block electrons. And once we say that, we say, okay, that's great, and we try and forget about the fact that the exact quasiparticles are horribly complicated things. We forget about their wave functions. And try and deal just with them in some abstract way, with their energies, etc. We write things like the energy is epsilon k minus mu, delta mk plus 1 over 2b, sum of k prime, k prime, delta mk prime. So the usual view in Landau Fermi liquid theory is at least transport and thermodynamic quantities do not depend on the wave functions of the block states. Landau theory is sort of formulated entirely in that way. So now you can see there's sort of a challenge here. So it was already true for non-interacting electrons without spin orbit that was the case. We could describe semi-classical dynamics of electrons without knowing the block states. But in these spin orbit coupled systems, that's not true. The anomalous velocity requires some understanding of the block states. Landau theory sort of, as a matter of principle, tries to hide from us the wave function. So how do we reconcile these things? So how should you think about this anomalous velocity in interacting Fermi liquid? And are there qualitatively new features in that case? So that's all this has been motivation. In the remaining 5 minutes, summarize the very complicated Keldysh calculation which he has done. At least you have understood the question. So I think, given the time, we'll only pretty much talk about the answers to the extent we understand them. How do you think about this Berry phase, Berry curvature, etc., in a Fermi liquid? These are the two questions really should be asking, and are there qualitatively new effects? So I'll give sort of partial answers to these questions. I guess I have to tell you a little bit about what we actually did. How would you try and address this? Suppose you're just thinking blindly, what would you like to do? Well, we're trying to understand how you understand the semi-classical dynamics of quasiparticles. We have a many-body formulation, many-body interacting system. How do you address that? Well, there is a kind of classic route, which is well developed again in helium 3 and applied sparingly elsewhere in solid state physics to achieve the semi-classical limit, which is basically start with the density matrix for Green's function. You can write a Dyson equation for it. Is really done in some, we're interested in real-time dynamics with some kind of Keldysh formulation. You take a Wigner transform, so only some tiny fraction of the specialists in here will understand these words, but given the time, there's no point. by bigger transforming this thing, you can define quantity, which is the whose semi-classical limit is the distribution function. So taking this thing as a standard route to derive a quantum kinetic equation. It can define an object which has the nice properties you expect for a distribution function of quasi-particles. And from that, you can read off the and its characteristics give you the quasi-particle equations of motion and other things. Okay. So that's a quite involved, nasty analysis. I will just try and tell you what that gives. No, I shouldn't erase that bottom thing. So from that thing, it turns out we can derive some more general, this is done in some rather general context, any more or less any spin orbit interacting model, your favorite, Roshka, of course, Ledger, other things. What we find is comforting. So from the non-interacting limit, one can re-derive actually the semi-classical dynamics in this way. With interactions, we find almost the same thing. You get the usual block term. You get this Berry curvature. But actually, there's an additional term on this. We get the sign here. That doesn't matter to any of you. I'll just guess it. These are functions of k. Some strange new object, which looks like we call E to suggest like electric field. And dk dt is unchanged.
And it is just E which comes from interactions.
Yeah, so this is always zero in a non-interacting system. This is almost exactly the same story. Okay, so let me tell you what this thing is, where it comes from. Actually, staring at this and remembering we're talking about an interacting system, you might ask a simpler question, where does this come from? We have an interacting system, what are the block states? How do I define that B? Okay. So it turns out, one of the basic precepts of Fermi liquid theory is that as you get close and closer to the Fermi energy, these peaks get sharper and sharper and sharper. So the Green's function has a delta function pole right up to the Fermi energy. In an ordinary system, you can actually try and define, the natural thing to try and do is actually suggested by Haldane, is to take the inverse Green's function, I won't be too specific. So normally this is something like omega minus E minus the self-energy. Okay. In a multi-band system, this would be a matrix. Okay. And we can define its eigenstates to be, so they diagonalize this thing. Now, you might worry a little bit, so the Green's function is not Hermitian, generally speaking. Remember in Fermi liquid theory, standard Fermi liquid theory arguments tell us that the lifetime, which is the non-Hermitian part of the Green's function, goes like omega squared at low frequency. So actually, if we're willing to work only for order omega, we can treat the Green's function as though it were Hermitian and define block states as eigenstates of the inverse single particle Green's function. That seems maybe arbitrary, but it's a that's a useful one, and basically the one that comes out of this treatment. Okay. So the key point here is that, so if you want, you know, you can, before diagonalizing, this thing has a kind of matrix structure with a matrix self-energy, which is generally non-diagonal. So you're, what you're really doing is diagonalizing the self-energy. And the point is, this, the structure of that matrix evolves as a function of frequency. So in a non-interacting system, of course, there's no frequency dependence, and these things are frequency independent. But with interactions, they do depend on frequency. So with these things, you can define the usual Berry curvature as an interacting, non-interacting system. A Berry reach function like this. Sorry, vector potential like this. But in fact, there's another object that is an equally natural interacting system, which is a kind of the zero component of that vector potential, describing how these things vary as a function of frequency. And so this electric field is just, and I'm going over, I apologize. I'll try to finish. So this electric field is just minus d omega a plus dk a zero, which is also gauge invariant, evaluated at zero frequency. So right on the premise surface. So you can see that this is not totally, it's a natural object, also gauge invariant. It's not a totally unfamiliar object, if you remember. So this is going to be related to frequency derivatives of the self energy at the Fermi energy. So there's another object in Fermi liquid theory, which is that, which is the Z factor. So this seems to be somehow related to the Z factor in Fermi liquid theory.
But essentially, the broadening doesn't enter anymore at that stage.
It doesn't enter because we're only at linear order of frequency.
Right. Yeah. So it's just a reduction.
Now, I wish I could tell you I have a nice intuitive understanding of this at the same level as I have for B, but I don't. So that's an open question. So let me, since I've gone on too long, let me just briefly say something about, you know, where this has implications. I'm sure there are many in principle, but there are a couple that we are easy to identify. So one is the one is for the anomalous Hall effect. So if you apply this to a time reversal symmetry broken system like a ferromagnet, since we have an expression for the velocity, we can calculate again the current dk dt is non-zero in the presence of a real electric field and obtain a purely Hall conductivity from it. And what you find is you get an integral, this V, I'll just write it for one band, but you just sum contributions for different bands, times the distribution function. So not surprisingly, you know, this is the result that you get in non-interacting theory. With interactions as a correction. So I should emphasize, if you start thinking about magnitude of this thing, at least in a metal for which RS, so the ratio of potential to kinetic energy of an electron, is order one, there's no reason for this thing to be small. So I think this is probably a quantitatively significant correction to the anomalous Hall conductivity in a magnetic metal. And I should mention that although we use this rather complicated way of deriving this, it's actually a nice check. So it turns out that it's possible to write an exact formula for the Hall conductivity in terms of the exact single particle Green's function, which is something that was developed in the context of the quantum Hall effect. It's using a Ward identity basically to rewrite the vertex corrections in terms of the exact single particle Green's function. And so, in fact, if you know the exact single particle Green's function, you can try and define some effective bands in it by introducing some unitary transformation which diagonalizes it. So these basically are related to these U's. They're putting U's in the columns and the rows. And this Fermi liquid theory tells us this thing has poles. Plugging this into this exact formula, you get exactly this. So this is actually, for the Hall part, this is the exact result so defined. I'll mention one other effect, which is, again, I mentioned this thing seems to be connected to the Z factor. You might think that this artificial electric field, that's what we're calling it, would affect the quasiparticle weight. And actually, so what we find is it does, but only if you apply electric or magnetic field so that decay dt is not zero. So if you do that, this thing is reduced by some form like this, where these should be evaluated at the decay of the quasiparticle. Actually, a result like this, so this ought to be obtained in a non-interacting system, and Chan Yu has derived something very similar to this, although I have to confess he doesn't have his factor of a half, so I'm slightly confused by that. Okay, so I've gone way over. I would like to say just speculations about where this is going, but I think we should give them a big round. Thanks.
So the incoherent background is also not in these equations, right?
That's right, yeah. The incoherent
is some relaxation in the equation?
Right. So, you know, what we actually derived is this quantum kinetic equation. Yeah, so what we've actually done is there's a way to separate that, which basically corresponds to separating the Hermitian and anti-Hermitian parts of the self-energy. So there's a systematic way to separate dissipationless and dissipative terms.
That's just a dissipationless.
Yeah, this is just a dissipationless part. So actually, we haven't yet looked in detail at the what would be properly called a collision integral or scattering terms. But yeah, that's also obviously there are many important effects there. We are primarily interested in how these semi-classical periphase dynamics would emerge in interacting systems as a secondary effect.
Yeah, is there a small RS expansion actually involved in this calculation? I mean, usually, you know, when you do this type of interacting systems and the whole Fermi liquid bubble type of approximation base, is that also used here?
I don't think so, in principle. I mean, so in principle, one, but okay, it's a question. I mean, it is, but all orders are resummed. So it's a. It's assuming that we're somehow in the regime of perturbative analysis of the Fermi liquid.
So this result over there is this new effective electric field that is supposed to be valid also for, I mean, for any value of RS. So typically,
yeah,
the Fermi liquid expansion only makes sense if RS is smaller than one.
But well, so, I mean, so, you know, the Landau picture of Fermi liquid theory is that the, you know, the general framework, like the structure of the free energy, is well defined for any RS provided you're in the Fermi liquid. So I believe that these results have a similar range of validity, and that's the assumption. So this doesn't, you know, this is not a leading order in one of our RS, in RS calculation.
So
like
you're
that.
Not but selecting a special set of diagrams?
No, so what, basically one could take the exact Dyson equation and manipulate it. So what's actually been done, I didn't mention, in deriving this quantum kinetic equation, one makes a gradient expansion. So the assumption is that in equilibrium, you know, we know by translational invariance that the distribution doesn't depend on the center mass position. So that, we believe, you know, that should be exact for any RS. So if we're close to equilibrium, that's what's been assumed, you can make a gradient expansion. So when I obtain some structure and certain things, you know, so if I actually wanted to compute E, I would only be able to do it order by order in RS, given an interacting system. But the form, we, you know, that's...
Do you have an... what's the best you can do to interpret physics of this term?
I don't know. I mean, like I said, so that this thing is, has to do with there being, basically being a dipole moment in the quasiparticle that Barry curvature has that interpretation. So I suspect that what it has to do with is there's a dipole moment due to the screening cloud of electron hole pairs around a quantum particle. something like that.
And I think that, you know, this decay, for example, from point of view of linear response theory, however you formulate it, you can think of as arising from basically electric field induced interband coherence,
yeah, that's also true here.
Which you integrate out curves. In effect, right? And then you can fold it into an anomalous velocity.
Yeah, that's done here as well.
Now, if I think about just like the Kubo formula, right? So I have two Green's functions, and you're putting in self energies in these Green's functions, and maybe you're putting in vertex corrections that correspond to that. And so somehow these Green's functions, you know, since you're using this around the Fermi energy expansion, have to be in the same band, not in different bands. So I think it might be different in that sense. Right? In other words, if I have two bands in a ferromagnet anyway, if one of the bands is near the Fermi energy, that's linear in omega expansions, can't be valid for both bands. So they must both be at the Fermi energy.
Well, omega is small. It's mixing with bands that are not at the Fermi energy. But that's what allows you to integrate them out, essentially.
So my question is there an issue about the bands away from the Fermi energy and how the imaginary part of the self energy is treated?
I don't think we actually need to assume anything about the sharpness of the spectral function of those states. You have to assume that when you look at the kinetic equation for the band, which is actually half the Fermi energy, that's sharp. It's a good question. I don't have
it. It may be that it just needs to be sharp compared to how far away it is. In other words, that its energy is relatively meaningful.
I'm not sure that it's necessary. That's a good picture of it.
Why did you emphasize the absence of inversion symmetry? It seems to me that B originates only from the fact that you have Galilean and non-invariant system. In Landau's theory, Galilean invariant system, and that's why there is no B.
Yeah.
As soon as you write the coordinate in the block representation, such a term appears even without a breaking of the inversion symmetry.
So the only reason I emphasize it was because it's simpler. So with inversion symmetry and time reversal, you have two full degenerate bands.
But this term appears even with them. That's a cross product of sigma by momentum.
I completely agree. It's just the structure is mathematically a little more complicated, because as you think of it's quite interesting. If you think of these two-fold degenerate bands, you sort of think of them like spin. They're not really spin eigenstates. They're some Cramer's inversion doublets. As they transport, I'm sure it's obvious to you, but maybe not to everyone else. As electron transports in this band, it doesn't just accumulate a phase. It rotates in this spinner space as a function of k. So, in general, for such a centrosymmetric metal, you have not a U1 but a SU2 various phase. So the structure is quite a bit more involved. Very interesting. There are other qualitatively different effects there that I don't feel quite as confident about. With interaction. But you're completely right. Yeah. I was only for simplicity, not for necessity.
What I don't quite understand is whether these interaction effects just normalize your conductivities, which would be, I think, very difficult to measure because you cannot switch on and off the interactions, or whether there are really some signatures which you would say, okay, so this effect would only be visible in the presence of interaction.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, so, this effect doesn't look not obvious that this is qualitative in that sense, although it's quantitative. If you were
order
doing
one.
A band structure calculation, order one, yeah. If you're doing a band structure calculation, you know, you ought to be somehow calculating the linear part of the self-energy and frequency and getting this correction as well. This thing actually is, although, I mean, this is somewhat far-fetched, but there actually is a qualitative effect here in principle. So if you think, so at least we can do a thought experiment. We'd like to measure the spectral weight of a quasiparticle in a weak applied field. Okay, so in a non-interacting system, if you apply a weak magnetic field, orbital magnetic field, you get a renormalization of the quasiparticle weight. But there's no effect if you apply a weak electric field. But there is with interactions. That's qualitatively different. But it's extremely
it's very
difficult to measure.
Difficult to measure.
Yeah, yeah, right. It's not impossible. I can see that, but. I would claim that's an indication that there are at least potentially qualitative effects, but I completely agree at this point. This is, you know, somewhat formal. It'd be nice to connect that in a switch to something formal.
One last question.
I had a similar question. If you would start from a DFT calculation or from a Hartree-Fock wave function, then there are parts of the interaction included already.
Right.
And how do you distinguish between the interaction that you discuss explicitly with respect to these interactions?
So imagine so the B already is actually, you know, it's not the, if imagine we start with a model, we're thinking about a relatively lightly doped electron gas in gallium arsenide or something, the Rajpa interaction. So we take our model to be gellium with some low density of electrons, and we could try and do Hartree-Fock on it or something. Okay. So that you could define this B here. Okay. The B that appears here is not the bare one from the band structure. It's actually the Hartree-Fock B. But this is an additional effect. But yeah, I mean, you can. It's everything here has a precise definition in terms of the Green's functions. If you have a scheme for computing them, you